You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to David of Tea Leaf Nation. David is a co-founder and co-editor of the website Tea Leaf Nation, which we will be hearing a lot more about in a moment. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School, and he also spent some time in China during the Peace Corps, and he's here to talk to us today. So welcome, David.
Thanks. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming out. I know it's pretty cold today. Particular, you know, thanks to the Berkman Center and the MIT Center for Civic Media for inviting me. It's really fun to be here. So my talk today is called Redefining the Quote, Using the Social Web to Gauge Grassroots Sentiment in China. So I'll just jump right in. So I practiced corporate law for a few years, and after that left and moved to Washington, D.C. I'm based there now. In December of 2011, with a couple of law school friends, I co-founded a website called TealeafNation.com. TealeafNation, this is just a screenshot, is a website that seeks to aggregate and synthesize China's online chatter into accessible English language stories. TealeafNation is currently a partner site with TheAtlantic.com. That started in September of last year, so a good amount of our content will also be cross-posted on the Atlantic, on the Atlantic's international channel and soon to be their China channel. In addition, we're a partner site with the Asia Society's Chinafile.com, which is a great site. I encourage everyone to check out if you're interested in China. So I want to give an extremely brief introduction to the Chinese social media landscape. And this remains, I think, how I personally see it. This is an 800-pound gorilla, or maybe he's 500 pounds, and he represents Sina Weibo. So Weibo is literally means microblog and is a Twitter-like platform in China. Sina is a for-profit NASDAQ-listed private company that administers the most popular of these Weibo platforms at Weibo.com. Weibo now has surpassed 400 million registered accounts, which is not the same as a number of people, but that's still impressive given that it has been around for less than 4 years. It generates approximately 150 million tweets or posts per day. Just to give you a sense of its sort of import, Yale Global has called it a vigorous virtual public square, and I think that's about right. It's the closest thing to a free speech platform for debate about the issues of the day in China. It's a platform for breaking news and stories. It provides a window into Chinese attitudes and Chinese life. And that's a window that we seek to open every day at Tea Leaf Nation to bring Chinese grassroots sentiment to a Western audience. And finally, I think you can argue that it is a steam valve for discontent. Some people have said that because of the number of users who go onto Weibo.com to complain about their government or their lives, in fact, it causes people to speak rather than to do, and actually acts as a curb on collective action. I'm not going to get into that today. I think that's an impossible counterfactual to answer. But that's a very brief introduction. Now, many people say Weibo is a Twitter-like platform, and that's sort of accurate. It has a number of features that Twitter does not. Just to give you a picture, this is actually a somewhat dated screenshot of Sina Weibo. It's got some bells and whistles now, but this is the basic stuff. A few things I think are of import. The first is something that you can't see, which is there is a 140-character limit on Weibo, just as there is on Twitter. But the Chinese language is essentially a denser language than English. So you can fit a much longer form thought into a 140-character tweet. I did a little test, and you can fit three Tang Dynasty poems into one tweet with a few characters left over for commentary. So if you're feeling ambitious. That's one part. In addition, there's the ability, which I know Twitter has, but more seamlessly, to embed, for example, photographs or JPEG files. So here you see, if you look at this circle on the left, somebody has embedded a sort of long-form essay, which is a great way to obviously express a more detailed thought and also to evade censors because it's very hard to scan a JPEG for sort of keywords. In addition, if you look at this top tweet there, underneath it, it's circled in red, are two numbers. On the left is the number of times that that tweet has been retweeted or reposted, and on the right is the number of comments that it has garnered. So it's a bit different from American Twitter. Twitter has a bit of a miss it or it's gone element to it. It's harder for a discussion to form. If something is being frequently retweeted, you're just going to see it over and over again. This instead creates sort of an automatic scoring mechanism. The tweet or the post just sits there, and you can see it accumulating retweets and comments, which gives you some sense of the virality or the importance of the tweet right on its own. What that also means is that when you click, for example, on the comments, there will be a drop-down which shows you all of the comments on that tweet. Now, what that means is that an ad hoc discussion forum can form around a particularly resonant or interesting tweet in a way that makes it actually a very fertile ground to mine if you're trying to get a sense of grassroots sentiment, because there's a discussion right there in, sort of embedded in the tweet. So that's the quick intro to what I'm going to be talking about today. So the question of how we get quotes, how we gauge sentiment, and the legitimacy of our project is a question obviously dear to my heart that I've been thinking a bit about. It's also something that's increasingly come to the attention of mainstream media. This problem is a thorny one. Apologies for the text blocks, but I did a quick look at the Reuters Handbook of Journalism online, the URL's at the bottom, and the longest section in the Essentials of Reuters Sourcing actually touches on social media. It mentions in particular that the importance of Twitter and the internet is especially true in countries or circumstances where the regular free flow of information is impeded. I think that fairly describes the Chinese media realm. It also notes that verification can be a major issue. You don't always know if the facts that you're seeing, the purported facts, are true. And journalists, of course, should be aware of the existence of sleeper or shadow Twitter accounts that look like official sources but are designed to peddle misinformation. Just to give you one example of how that may happen in China, there's a concept of the Wu Mao Party on the Chinese internet, which refers to a purported group of posters of social media users in China who are paid 50 Chinese cents for every pro-government post that they write. Now, how widespread that is impossible to say, but if you're on the Chinese internet and you want to insult someone as being a government shill, you call them a Wu Mao. So obviously these questions are quite germane to Chinese social media. So let me just get into a few of the major problems with using social media quotes. I'm very proud of myself. I managed to generate a meme. It hasn't gone viral yet. Maybe you can help me. So the first problem, as I see it, is authenticity. Now, again, the question is, you know, do we use a social media sourced quote versus a traditional quote, right? So instead of calling up someone on the phone, interviewing the proverbial man on the street in China, or emailing an expert and asking them directly what they think, we're going online and culling these social media quotes that are already sitting out there for us to capture. So that's the question. And one of the problems with the Tea Leaf Nation approach is authenticity. First, of course, as I just mentioned, there's an issue with the authenticity of identity. Right? Is this person who they claim to be? Is it even a person? Right? Maybe it's just a zombie account that was created in order to juice somebody's numbers. There's also a question about the authenticity of sentiment, even where identity has been established. This is what a China watcher named Kaiser Kuo called perverse game mechanics. And here's the way I see it. So Weibo's interface, its ability to create these ad hoc discussion fora that I just mentioned, makes it very easy for everyone to, first of all, see how many retweets and comments they're getting. It builds in a sort of automatic scoring system for the virality of your comment. The best way, of course, to get attention on the internet, as we know, is often to be outlandish. And what will often happen, or at least sometimes, is that one person will make an outlandish comment, and someone else will try to top them with an even more strident or even more outlandish comment. And ultimately, in certain discussion threads, you can reach a tipping point where there are so many users sort of stumbling over each other to make a more strident point that what I would consider the reasonable voices tend to withdraw from that discussion forum, rendering that discussion forum a poor gauge of what online users are actually thinking. There's really no way around this that I can see. We know that it's in the background, but there's no way to control for it. The best thing that we can do, and that we try very hard to do, is to choose sort of high-quality discussion threads where we don't see this happening. But that is a question of gut instinct and experience more than quantifiability. Of course, we also use multiple threads to try to bring together a cohesive picture of what Chinese internet users are thinking. So that's one big problem. Another problem is censorship. Now, I don't actually find this a very persuasive argument against using social media for quotes in China. Chinese mainstream media, first of all, is censored. In fact, the internet is the most trusted source of news, at least for a subset of the Chinese population. So according to BCG, a consultancy, 70% of Chinese young professionals and 63% of Chinese university students trust the internet more than any other sources. Also, censorship does not eliminate anti-government sentiment per se. I think someone unfamiliar with Chinese social media would be shocked by the level of candor that they find online there. And one reason, actually, as a researcher named Gary King at Harvard has established by analyzing blog posts, not microblog posts, is that the government is more concerned with threads or topics that might lead to collective action. They don't necessarily eliminate everything that's sort of anti-government or pro-reform. So I think there's a lot of rich source material still on the Chinese internet. And I also think that it's important to focus on what people are trying to say, even with the existence of censorship. I think if you only focus on censorship, which is, of course, a valuable and important project, you are essentially letting the government's priorities become the narrative and monopolize the discussion. I think it's important to move past censorship as much as you can in order to give a voice to the sentiment that is there, that people are trying to express. Another problem, representativeness. People will often say, well, Chinese internet users do not represent the Chinese population at large, and therefore, even if you can get a good picture of grassroots sentiment on the Chinese net, that doesn't tell you what Chinese people think as a whole. And that's true. I think this is a real issue. Social media analysis in this way really can't show the full picture. And you need, you know, boots on the ground reporting. You need traditional quotes in order to supplement what you're missing. So I have a picture here of just an older Chinese gentleman. And I bet he has some tremendous stories to share. But I also bet that he's not frequently on Weibo. So somebody needs to go and talk to people like this. These underrepresented groups. Social media cannot give the full picture, and that's true. But I would say this. First of all, the Chinese internet now has 564 million users, which is going on to 50% of all of China. By about 2015, should have crossed 50%. Now, obviously, as internet penetration deepens into the Chinese heartland, the mass of netizens, or internet users writ large, will look more like China. And there's another thing worth noting, and it's not fortunate, but I think it's true. Certainly, internet penetration has almost reached saturation point in some of Chinese richer, more coastal, more urban areas. However, the young, the educated, the wealthier Chinese, I think, do reflect the likely future leaders of China in many cases. So if you want to get a sense of what the next generation of China's leaders are thinking, it's probably a good bet to look at social media. And finally, I'd add that we can exaggerate the degree to which Chinese internet users are elite. In fact, there was a recent study by IDG Excel, which is an investment firm, and they talked about how 300 million Chinese internet users would probably describe themselves as diaosi, which is a word that basically means like nobody. They would call themselves nobodies. These are people with incomes of less than $500 US a month, people who live in third, fourth, and fifth tier cities. These are people who are still moving up in Chinese life, but they could not be described, I think, as elite within China. One more problem, cherry picking. I hear this a lot, actually. People say, well, with all of those quotes out there, a journalist who's predisposed to make a particular point can easily find evidence to back that up. I think that although this image is delicious, the argument is probably unpersuasive. The truth is that you can always cherry pick quotes. You can cherry pick traditional quotes by choosing what you run and what you don't, by choosing whom you talk to, and by choosing how you interpret what people are saying. So I just think there are fewer cherries of all flavors in traditional journalism land, but you can still pick them. Okay, I want to talk about some of the advantages of social media as a source of quotes. The biggest advantage, I think, is the candor or the spontaneity of the quote. In a way, this is a counterpart to the authenticity problem that I raised earlier. Chinese internet users are speaking to each other, or at least they think they are. They're not speaking to a member of the foreign press. So we are essentially acting as a fly on the wall, getting unfiltered conversation. And of course, there are gamification elements, which I described, that often tend to drive internet speech to the extreme. However, if you're going to choose between internet users who are trying to impress their countrymen and people who are trying to filter their speech for a member of the foreign press, which choice would you make? I actually think in this respect, social media quotes are more attractive. They're more likely to be spontaneous, and they're more likely to be honest, in my opinion. Another advantage is numerosity, an inverse of the cherry-picking problem. So I try to get a picture of lots of different colored cherries, but these are actually cherry tomatoes, so I had to cheat. So assuming that your search inputs are correct and wise, the depth of your research is sound, you can, as a social media-facing journalist, synthesize a swath of opinions that is far more likely to be representative than quotes that have been drawn from a dozen or even several dozen sources. I mean, you can read hundreds or thousands of quotes and sort of synthesize them together in sort of like a Zagat guide super quote, which contains the key elements of sentiment drawn from a variety of different sources. Another advantage is transparency. I don't hear a lot about this, but I think it's quite interesting. The truth is that when you use social media, it's certainly easier to practice lazy journalism, but it's actually harder to practice out-and-out fraud. Everything that you say, assuming that you're focusing on internet sentiment, assuming that you're quoting social media users, can be double-checked, assuming the post hasn't been censored. We link to the handles of each person that we quote, and their quote is there, admittedly in Chinese, for anyone to go in and double-check. Now, the vast majority of reports, of course, are true. Journalists are honest, and most of the quotes that the traditional quotes they're giving are not fabricated. But I do think it's worth noting that because we source from social media, it's a bulwark against fraud. You can't make up a quote and not be caught. That's not the same as saying that the internet is a per se trustworthy place. I don't think it is. You only need a few thousand fools to start a rumor. But as an individual source of information, we can be checked. And what we do can be checked. And finally, it's better than the alternative. It's very important to look at what your alternatives are when you're talking about these kinds of journalistic approaches. And as I think, Reuters rightly pointed out, in countries like China, there is an issue with the regular and free flow of information. As I showed earlier, a lot of internet users don't trust Chinese mainstream media. Now, Chinese mainstream media is filled with many fine reporters, but they face a level of control and censorship that you could never exercise, in my opinion, over the Chinese internet short of shutting the thing down. In particular, if we're going to look at it from a legal perspective, right, there's this idea of prior restraint. In Chinese mainstream media, when we're talking about, for example, a printed newspaper, a censor can order that an article never be brought to press, that it is never seen. That basically can't happen in social media. It's extremely easy, obviously, to publish anything, and the way that censors work with Chinese social media is they generally delete posts after the fact rather than stopping speech before it's happened. But of course, as we know, once you have rung a particular bell, once you've gotten news out there, it's very hard to unring it. And so that's another reason, I think, that social media quotes are actually quite useful. So I want to speak briefly about best practices for the future of journalism. And I will boldly say that I think this kind of journalism is here to stay. I think using social media to gauge sentiment, to draw quotes, to redefine the quote is here to stay. So what can we establish as best practices moving forward? First, let me just tell you a bit about how I think of stories that we run on Tea Leaf Nation. So it depends on what practices we, I think, sort of adopt. It depend on social media's relationship to the story. So there's what I would call intrinsic and then extrinsic. So intrinsic stories, stories that are intrinsic to social media, emerge from within the social media sphere. So this, for example, could be a meme or a viral thread, a viral comment. Extrinsic would mean that the story occurs completely outside of social media, then we go into social media in order to see how that real-world event has redounded within it. Here's an example, a classic extrinsic story. I went online a few months ago after Putin was, I guess we'll say, reelected, and tried to gauge how Chinese netizens had reacted to that. Obviously, Vladimir Putin has nothing to do with Weibo. This is the kind of story that we originally set out to do. But in fact, we found in many cases that the discussion threads, the discrete threads that I mentioned earlier, were not there. Instead, we found results that were very diffuse and that become very hard for a human being to synthesize. An example of a classic intrinsic story, a user right after the American election, a Chinese internet user put together this image of what a Chinese electoral multi-party democracy might look like. Here's an electoral map. The red is the Communist Party. The blue is Taiwan's ruling Kuomintang, and everything else is swing. So this emerged completely from within Chinese social media, and it created a singular discussion thread where we could mine that thread and that thread alone in a closed universe analysis in order to gauge reaction. And there were thousands of comments, so we could get a pretty rich picture. Lately, we've tended more toward this type of story, and I think one best practice is to focus more on stories like this, where it's easier to quantify. Where the analysis is less diffuse. But truth be told, pretty much everything is in the middle. This spectrum, of course, is merely an intellectual construct. It gets hopelessly muddled because behavior within the internet is responsive to outside stimuli. And indeed, it may say more. How we categorize a given article probably says more about the methods and the mindset of the journalist than it does about the topic. It depends where you start. Do you start your research looking for a meme or a thread and then researching the larger issue? Or are you going in the reverse, and do you stumble upon the meme or the thread serendipitously? How diffuse or how focused is your investigation? So really, this breaks down upon scrutiny. But it's helpful. Here's another solution, or another best practice, rather. Let the numbers speak for themselves. We always try to say, you know, how many times has a topic been discussed? How many times has something been retweeted upon or commented upon? That kind of automatic scoring that we were talking about earlier. Now, giving these hard numbers, you know, is just a rough shorthand, but it at least gives a sense of the scope of the inquiry. You know, the disadvantage is that it's easy to amass impressive numbers on Chinese social media, where we have hundreds of millions of users. And often, a reader who's new to the subject maybe cannot understand that context. The other thing is that numbers themselves, I think, can be cheap or low-quality numbers, or they can be high-quality numbers. I think it reintroduces a lot of the questions that I raised before. Are these users that are commenting, giving their thumbs up, are they real users? Is it one person masquerading as 10 people? Are they being paid by the government or by a corporation? So this, again, is not a complete solution. Another best practice is to include verified experts in the discussion. We, of course, at Tea Leaf Nation anyway, are trying to gauge grassroots, widespread sentiment within China. But expert social media commentary provides valuable context. It helps to moor a discussion, to ground a discussion, often because well-known users have a reputational risk that your sort of average internet user does not have. And so they're a bit more leery about writing something that's too extreme. So usually if there's a big issue or breaking news and all of the experts are silent about it, you need to start to wonder whether this is in fact just a rumor. Of course, there's a tension here, right? Expert opinion, if we let it come to monopolize a conversation, we're losing sight of our original intent to gauge grassroots sentiment. This comes down to editing the article well. Another possibility, another best practice, take an open desk approach. At Tea Leaf Nation, we try to constantly convey doubt about everything but our core skill set. And for us, that is curation, that is sentiment analysis. So we'll focus on a thread or a discussion and be quite confident about our conclusions there. But we try to use very careful language when drawing a larger conclusion to how everyone in China is feeling. Of course, there's also a subtle tension here, right? What we don't know is an infinite set. If we get into it, we can risk drowning out all of the valuable information in what we're writing. Again, this comes down to good editing. And I also think it's important for each participant, I guess, in this discussion to know their role. So, you know, we view ourselves as part of a total information mix for our readers. You know, we don't seek to be a paper or publication of record, and I think that idea may itself be outdated. You know, instead, information is being constantly shared and remixed in a massive ongoing conversation, much like the very conversations that we seek to track. So we view ourselves as providing a valuable input, but not a singular final output. We're just a part, a voice in this conversation. Finally, it would be cool to invent something. I think an automated social media analytical tool for journalists that focus on China would be tremendously powerful. We actually applied for funding to get this, but weren't able to. There's a few others who want to do this as well. I think it would be tremendously valuable. Now, if we create this sort of automated engine that can interpret and analyze sentiment across thousands or millions of posts on Chinese social media, there's all sorts of problems. You need a human being in the loop, I think, always. You need a human being to ask the right questions, to interpret and contextualize results, and gauge the quality and the truthfulness of the conclusions that this machine is reaching. But I would love to see something like this. Right now at Tea Leaf Nation, we use sort of a brute force approach. And I think that's what everyone else does. And that is what opens us up to charges, for example, of cherry picking. And so if we can replace ourselves with a machine that takes a sort of first cut at online sentiment analysis, it would be tremendously useful in what we're trying to accomplish. So I'll stop there. I'd love to take any questions that you guys have. Just wanted to say thanks for coming.
Approach, mm-hmm. Is that to say that you're doing everything by hand? You're not using any algorithms? You're not using any analytic systems?
That's right.
Old school.
Old school. As old school as you can be writing about Chinese social media.
Yeah, but how do you deal with the volume of when you've got 150 million tweets a day? How do you deal with that manually?
Right. I mean, some of the, what I guess you'd call good news in this particular instance, is that a lot of what's being written about online doesn't concern us as journalists, right? So not that it's not valuable and important stuff, but we don't write about, the NBA, and we don't write about, people's favorite movies, usually. And so a lot of what people are tweeting about is just their daily lives, celebrities, their preferences. All of that stuff doesn't go in, right? But yeah, it's tremendously difficult, and that is partly why we try to conduct more closed universe analyses now. Right, where we focus on a particular, particularly resonant or viral image or discussion thread or tweet, and really drill down on that. And that allows you to bite off something that you can start to chew. You know, even if there are 10,000 comments on something, you know, if you read the first couple hundred and the last couple hundred, sample from, you know, the middle of the discussion, make sure that things haven't changed too much over time, you can start to see a repetition in a lot of the sentiments, and begin to break down sentiment into sort of different argumentative buckets that you can then collect representative quotes for and present a story.
Commercially available to tools like Crimson Hexagon and those types of things?
We have no money.
Okay.
No, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's a partnership that we'd love to explore, and you know, we would love to be able to do that. I think that's got to be the next step, because, you know, over the last year and a half, you really see mainstream journalists giving credence to Chinese online sentiment, which they should. But the problem is that a lot of readers, I think, are skeptical, and in some ways, they're rightly skeptical. If you have, for example, a New York Times article that ends with just one quote from China's online sphere, you have absolutely no idea if that quote is of any value, any representative value whatsoever. So I think there do need to be a set of best practices, and perhaps, you know, some kind of open source product that allows journalists to, you know, use a common, sort of a shared approach would be very valuable. Because I think it would be a shame, actually, if, you know, reader skepticism, which is in some ways well-grounded about this approach, caused journalists ultimately to turn away from it out of fear of basically being wrong, because this is such a valuable resource to tap. Hope so.
I get the feeling that your site is based on analysis rather than fast-breaking news, but there must be some kind of tension between trying to get something in a timely manner and doing the kinds of verification and careful work that you are trying to do.
That is absolutely true. There is always a tension between timeliness and quality, or timeliness and accuracy. And we have been both lucky and good so far in that we have not bit on some of the big internet rumors coming out of China. But inevitably, right, inevitably that's built in. And the fact is that we have broken news from time to time. And that's just partly because we watch the space so closely. We have so many writers who are watching this space closely, and a lot of other outfits don't. But yeah, I mean, you know, for example, a friend of mine called me from Hong Kong a few months ago because there had been a rumor that there was a high-level coup in China and the president was on the outs. And he said, you know, the markets are jittery, everyone's talking about this. And I went online, and quickly my gut reaction was that this can't be true from everything I saw. But there's no way to automate that, right? And if you were to use just an automated tool, for example, right there, you'd be completely caught in the teeth of these rumors.
So you can write with Chinese language now?
Yes. Yeah. I was a Peace Corps volunteer for a couple years in China from 01 to 03 and have spent a couple more years there. So
I have an idea. I've been working on this. Like, mainly the whole world is based on English. So like a news can come from Bangladesh or Japan or from India, but everything is influenced highly by English. So my philosophy is like, we have knowledge regardless of boundaries, culture, anything.
Right.
Knowledge can come from any country, from anyone. But we are not getting those knowledge. Only we are getting knowledge from English-dominated countries. So we should have a platform. And I'm just calling it like Media 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
It is not like traditional. So anyone can come and share the ideas, share the knowledge, regardless of the barriers of culture, language. So for that, actually, you need very big volunteers and or like a perfect interpreter or technological platform so that we can translate everything.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there is a huge chance of missing so many important points.
Right. I mean, it's a huge issue, right? Yeah. Because the internet
is Chinese obviously produce millions of tweets, how many tweets you can follow? Very few.
Right.
Thousands of people can follow total like 10,000 tweets, but there are so many tweets we can't follow because of the limitation time.
I completely agree. We're sort of trying to add our own little piece to that. You had a question as well?
Sure. It was kind of a follow-up on that. I was wondering to what extent you guys see instances of a rumor being tweeted and retweeted on Weibo, like because of, you know, problems with people not really understanding the average news and maybe not understanding how to verify facts. And kind of like during Sandy in New York City, like everyone thought the New York Stock Exchange was under 4 feet of water, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Are people really quickly, like, jump in to actually correct misinformation? How prevalent is that?
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't jump in, right? And some people will argue that there's a self-correction mechanism on the internet, but of course the problem is, even if that self-correction happens in 12 hours, well, you know, 18 million people have believed the information in that 12-hour interim. So I think it can be a very dangerous space when you're trying to reach hard conclusions about facts. And that's why we try to stick to our core skill set, which is sentiment. And when a purported set of facts is broken on the internet, we try to make the reaction our focus, because that reaction is real, even if the facts aren't. And you have to be very careful in that case to tag something as rumor. I mean, we'll even just say, you know, rumor watch, colon, our headline. But of course, if all you're ever doing is sort of, you know, putting out these sensational rumors, quickly you lose credibility as a source. So I think there's a balancing act, and you know, no one's sort of figured out yet how to solve this problem. Yes.
How do you separate a Wu Mao from someone who really believes, or someone who's tweeting a lot of very liberal ideas, from an overseas Chinese who's studying at Harvard?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe was born here.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, if we're the sort of stereotypical Wu Mao would be, you know, heavily pro-government, right, being paid by the government. So I guess you're asking sort of how do we distinguish that from someone who just feels that way, right? And of course, a worry that you always that I always have is, you know, am I appropriately correcting for this phenomenon? Am I overcorrecting because I, you know, don't want this comment to be a true reflection, right? And I think a lot of it just has to do with, you know, if it's a user which has 2 followers as opposed to, you know, 100 followers, that tells you something, right? Really sort of the level of care and love that they have put into their account gives you a sense of whether it's just been thrown up there very quickly. But there's no way to be sure. And yeah, it's a danger, absolutely. I mean, and to be clear, you know, it's not just Wu Mao, so-called Wu Mao, right? There are all sorts of other reasons to doubt, right, whether somebody is who they say they are, whether somebody actually feels what they've expressed. So it's a minefield, and that's just one of the bigger mines. You had a question as well?
I was wondering how many you know, tweets or whatever you have to look at in a story and just how you go about doing that, like how much time it takes, how many people involved.
Right, right. Well, it really depends. You know, I know what I do personally, and I know what I ask our writers to do, but it partly depends on how rich of a discussion thread there is. So if there are 10,000 comments, I want to see hundreds of those comments from different points along the timeline before I feel comfortable reaching a conclusion about sentiment. Sometimes it's just a short story where there's just a couple hundred comments. It's just an interesting thought. You know, we can sample a bit less rigorously there, or we could just have fewer samples, and that's fine. The other thing is, and it's a big distinction, are we trying to reach a conclusion about sentiment in the article? So sometimes it's enough, and this is often how we handle, you know, breaking news, is it's enough for us to translate an idea or an image into English to explain its provenance and to say, here is a sample of some of the quotes, or not even to list the quotes. But if we're actually going to say, users, you know, web users commenting on this post by and large felt X, that is where it triggers a much, you know, more fulsome inquiry.
The top post is your initial thing, the decision about what to look at first?
Yes. And that again, I think, is drawing the line between, if you can, between intrinsic and extrinsic to social media, right? So, yes, I mean, I try now, I think, and our writers also try now, to write posts that are often driven by what's happening within social media. And so that involves a first cut look at, you know, the top topics, the top posts, and of course, what Sina lists as the top posts may not match up with what some other data shows. So we'll use some great tools that researchers at Hong Kong University have developed, which show their list of the most viral. And then we go from there, of course, asking a fundamental question, which is, first of all, is this obviously a rumor or a lie? If not, does it tell the reader something larger about China? If it's just something that's sensational on its own, you know, a cat in some funny pose or something, that's great. I'm glad people enjoy it. But if it doesn't say something larger about China, we won't engage it. I saw some questions back there.
The media reports the government to be moving towards trying to reduce the amount of anonymity behind Weibo accounts.
Yeah.
Just wondering your own personal views of how successful you think they can be in terms of either using formal regulations or informal chilling effects on the major sites and so forth, and where you see that winding up perhaps 3 to 5 years from now, and how the nature of your own site and your own reporting will change as a result of this sort of cat and mouse dynamic that's going on.
Right, right. So, you know, the drive toward real name registration, for example, and what effect has that had and how might it affect us? You know, I think it's very hard to project, you know, even a couple years down the line. You know, Weibo itself didn't exist 4 years ago. Chinese had access to Twitter back then, which has since been blocked. And it's certainly what you would call, I guess, a risk factor for our site. If the government were to shut the Weibo platform down tomorrow, we would have to find, you know, we'd have to obviously beef up our look into other sources, and it's a risk. I think that the Chinese government has, you know, been pursuing this in fits and starts, and I can say that they've had limited success. I mean, if you ask me right now, you know, to find, for example, an anti-government post, whatever that means, right? It may just be somebody complaining about a local official and not the legitimacy of the Communist Party in general. But if you were to ask me to find a post like that, I could probably do it in 10 seconds. It's still a very honest place. And I think one reason is the position of these internet platforms. So Sina, as I said, is a for-profit NASDAQ-listed company, right? And censorship is a cost center. And so Sina, for example, is hopelessly conflicted when it has to manage both its users, who it depends on for monetization and for its very vitality, and the government, who, of course, can, if they wish, shut it down at any time. And so the government isn't sort of giving these direct orders to users and saying, you will use your real name. You know, they're asking, or they're telling Sina to do this, or these other companies like Tencent. And then those companies are, with varying degrees of compliance, carrying those orders out. So a big issue here was real name registration. And in, I think, March 15th of last year, there was a deadline for real name registration to be implemented on some of these social media platforms. What happened was, you know, companies like Sina kicked the can to telecom providers by saying that it was enough as a user to give your cell phone number, not your identity number. Because, of course, to get a cell phone number, you're supposed to show your ID. So it should be the same. But, of course, everyone knows it's not. And so that created a huge loophole. Now, recently, the Chinese, I think, State Council issued a new internet law, which, again, stresses real name registration. But we haven't seen how that's, you know, going to be carried out. So my take on it is one of cautious optimism with, of course, these chilling effects always lurking in the background as risks. And, you know, the good news is that it still remains a very vibrant place, even though the government does occasionally put its foot down. Yes?
Two questions for you. One is, how frequent is it that you see stories jumping from social media to mainstream media? Is it telling which stories do jump and which don't? And
right.
The other one is, after looking through these various discussion threads for a long time now, where do you come down on the siloing versus the liberation space in media?
In terms of the siloing versus liberation, can you say a bit more about
the classic question of whether social media is an echo chamber, whether people are flocking together, and rather than having real debate and deliberation in online spaces, they're just reinforcing their birds of a feather kind of. Or whether they're engaging with people with very, very different opinions there.
Right, right. Well, I think, yeah, I mean, in terms of your second question, I think that is something that we have to constantly be on the lookout for. And that's why, because on Weibo you have these sort of bubbles that pop up, right? These discrete discussion threads. And some discussion threads can be very high quality, and others can be very low quality, even if they're on the same topic. And so that really does come back down to sort of a gut check about whether you feel that extreme opinions are taking over a thread or not. But it is a constant risk. And I think really maybe the answer is it's sort of like it's both a particle and a wave. Like it's both an echo chamber, you know, and a valuable space for discussion at the same time. And the question, I think, is not whether you discount for that fact, but who should discount for that fact. I think as a reporter or as a journalist who's doing this work, we have to go out at it full throttle, doing our best, of course, to separate the wheat from the chaff, but ultimately leaving it to the larger conversation, the larger community of readers and journalists to decide how valuable this input is. And so I think if we're clear about the ambiguity inherent in this exercise, it's then up to, you know, the consumers of our content to decide, well, is it enough that I've read about, you know, the social media reaction to Vladimir Putin's election? Or do I also have to look at, you know, what China's State Council, for example, has said about it? And so your first question, sorry, do you mind repeating it? That's right. And I think it's pretty often. But of course, that may just be a function of the fact that social media moves so much more quickly, right? And mainstream media doesn't always have time to get to it. Maybe they were actually on it to begin with, and we just didn't know. But I think it's quite often. I mean, very recently, there was a censorship scandal with a Chinese newspaper called the Southern Weekend. And, you know, I certainly learned about it, of course, through social media, because the Southern Weekend wasn't going to tell anyone on its front pages. And ultimately, that, you know, required a mainstream media response, although it seemed to be a rather sort of ham-handed one. Even major news, for example, you know, the downfall of Chinese politician Bo Xilai, which began with his top lieutenant sort of trying to turn himself over to American authorities at the consulate in Chengdu, began with, you know, online chatter. Now, it's hard to say, right, whether social media's presence merely affected the speed that the story spread, or did it fundamentally change the character of the story, forcing mainstream media to respond in a new way? I tend to think it's the latter, but it's hard to say for certain.
How often does it skip mainstream media altogether? In other words, something happens in the social media space, and it exacts our response, whether by government, by company, by whoever, without playing out in mainstream media?
That's a good question. So how often does mainstream media simply not respond?
Yeah, it's too complicated because it's too slow because of whatever reason. Is it frequent that it just sort of leaps over mainstream media altogether, which wouldn't happen, I think, hasn't traditionally happened as much here, I would argue.
Right. That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer. I mean, I don't look at mainstream media in as systematic a way. My impression is that it doesn't happen all that often, but instead, mainstream media will respond in a way that is so discordant with what netizens are saying that it is effectively ignoring it. So the Southern Weekend example is a perfect one, right? The government responded, I think, unwisely with an editorial that through the pro-government Global Times, which said that, you know, foreign forces were sort of behind this outcry over the censorship of Southern Weekend. And then authorities demanded that other mainstream outlets run this same editorial. And so if you really were not looking at all at Chinese social media or Western media, and only at Chinese mainstream media, you may not have any idea of really even what they're talking about, right? Because it tends to be so coded. And it's responding to something that is silent within mainstream media. So I think it would actually be quite confusing if you were only a consumer of mainstream media in China. Yes.
You speak a lot about issues that involve like the national government through Beijing. How much do you focus on issues that are very specific to local governments and specific provinces? Because if you're talking about the effect of political discourse increasing amongst the citizens, it seems like they might have more leeway in local provinces and more localized issues.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, not everything we focus on is national in nature, certainly. And just to be clear, not everything we focus on is even political at all, right? You know, we do try to give a sense of what life is like in China. And sometimes, you know, we try to steer clear of the trivial, but we also try to steer clear of only, you know, showing these political issues. But I think when it does come to these political questions, often there is more leeway when it comes to local issues. But that's not because the users themselves happen to be, you know, localized. Rather, you can have a national discussion about local corruption. That is a classic example where you'll know pretty quickly whether the central government is on the local official's side or not. And usually it seems they're not. Usually people will discover a local official owning recently 31 homes, you know, or photos that go viral of a local official and a mistress, photos of them with expensive Rolexes or smoking cigarettes that cost $1,000 US dollars a box. And if that information hangs out there for more than 24 hours, you know that someone in the central government has basically decided to let this person go. And usually what happens is that, you know, these local officials, when they're called out for corruption, are ultimately reprimanded, often fired. And that feeds into a larger issue about the way China is structured. And, you know, the pervasiveness of corruption at the local level, and the central government in many cases is actually keen to help root this out, and may even prefer to rely on Chinese internet users to go sort of do this investigative work for them. Yes.
And just to jump on that last point you made, what are your reactions to, you know, Michael Ante's argument that Weibo, in fact, is a social media platform that helps the party stay in power because people can now use it as a pressure valve through which they can air their grievances or address their complaints without having the spillover effect of, you know, protesting onto the streets?
Right, yeah.
Could you repeat that question just so
absolutely, people... absolutely. So you were referring to Michael Ante, who's a very well-known blogger within China, and his argument sort of stated in a couple sentences is that he believes the existence of Chinese social media platforms where their servers are based in Beijing, you know, not Los Angeles, is actually helpful for the Chinese government because it lets Chinese citizens vent their spleen without actually doing anything that would threaten the government in the long term. Is that a fair sort of, and how do I respond to that? I mean, as I very briefly alluded to earlier, I think it's one of these counterfactuals that's impossible to solve because we'll never know what China would look like without the presence of Sina Weibo, right, or Tencent. But I think in my experience, like from what I've seen, that, how can I put this? It is certainly a valid complaint, right? It's a valid complaint to say, you know, if you read what you see online, you would think that, you know, the mass of Chinese internet users are ready to take up pitchforks and march to Beijing, and that that is not reflected in their real life behavior. But I also think that these kinds of dialogues on social media have a way of changing the tenor of the conversation. They certainly have had real world effects. Legal rulings have been changed, or it would appear that legal rulings have, you know, reflected online sentiment. Certainly, local officials, as I said, have been, you know, knocked off their horses because of online outcry. And I also think, in a more long-term way, it has the effect of opening China up, and we can't know the consequences of that, because if you have a minority opinion in China, you now know that you are not alone, right? You know that it's not just you who thinks, you know, that something should be changed. You can go online, you can find counterparts who agree with you. And I think it's very hard to say yet what the long-term effect of that will be, and I don't dare to venture a prediction. But I don't think we can simply say, you know, that it's had no effect. Yes?
I think I'd like to ask you about just the present way that this all functions and works. I mean, here you're sitting here. You are fluent in Mandarin, I assume, maybe not Cantonese. Your other people must be fluent in the language, too, and actually more than fluent, because a lot of the use of this web is not actually what the character says, but it can often be a representation of some symbol, of rhyming with something that they want to do. It can be a kind of tricky area to understand what's being said. So my point is it's a very specialized ability. Kind of both have a judgment about the topic, understand the language in all of its subtleties. So how do you make it go now in terms of the finances? And what do you see as the future? Because you've alluded to the fact that you've not gotten this grant money. So I'm just wondering, what does it take to keep it going now? Do, for example, Asia Society in the Atlantic give you money to be a part of this? Is that enough for you to do it? Or what are you looking at as your resources that are necessary to keep this effort going?
Right. Sort of broadly, you know, how do we do it and how are we going to keep doing it, right? No, I think that... Absolutely. And those are questions that are certainly near and dear to my heart. I will say this, you know, simply running our website costs almost nothing. Our volunteers, our contributors are volunteer contributors, and we try to give them exposure and mentorship and a sense of community in return, because right now we can't pay them. And hopefully they find that valuable enough to keep contributing for the time being. We certainly do need to get funding long term, though, just to pay the bills of certain personnel and certain editors. But you know, in terms of the art of analyzing Chinese social media, I would say that although our writers are a tremendously gifted group of people, I myself do not understand Mandarin and all of its subtleties, and I think some of our writers would say they don't as well. And this is a skill that can be learned, right? You're absolutely right that China, the Chinese internet has a very rich and constantly evolving lexicon of slang, partly because it's fun, partly because it makes it harder to censor. Exactly. And but, you know, Tea Leaf Nation was founded in December of 2011, and I wasn't on Chinese social media before that. But it's fundamentally a human medium, right? If you understand, you know, the way that you know, people think, then you're going to be able to learn how this all works by getting online. And that's really what our writers have done. They are from a wide variety of expertise. I think what unites our writers is that they tend to be bilingual, bicultural. Many of them are overseas Chinese, and they have the ability to both understand what's being said in Chinese social media and to present it to a Western English-speaking audience in a way that they'll appreciate. And I think that is absolutely fundamental to what we do. But I would definitely invite anyone who's curious and can read the Chinese to get on and give it a shot, because you can quickly become attuned to how it works.
One last point. I think the traffic rank of your website is pretty much good. So you can do some marketing campaign and also generate profit from online advertisement, and you can develop some tools so that you can interpret more data.
Yeah,
and it is possible because you have very good traffic rank, so many readers. So like generating profit is not a difficult job for Tea Leaf Nation.
Yeah, well, certainly I appreciate the encouragement, and you know, we are definitely thinking about that stuff. Yeah. I think part of it is, you know, what kind of organization do we wish to be? And some of the ways that we could make money risk transforming our focus and our organization such that we're not accomplishing what we originally set out to do. So, you know, I will just say this in short. Our goal, my goal, and I think a lot of our writers' goal, is to become an established and respected media organization. And any way that we can bring in revenue while still doing that, we'll do. But, you know, I always like to tell people, if we just put up cute pictures of cats, we could, you know, quintuple our traffic tomorrow, but then we wouldn't be what we are. So,
pressure valve thing. If we have another minute, so it seems like there's two very, very different aspects to this. One of them is the theory that allowing people to vent is going to reduce the collective action of the government. That was commonly cited in Egypt as one of the reasons why the blogosphere wasn't filtered there. So. There's an N of one to go with your lack of counterfactual, who knows. But anyway, I personally don't buy into that theory very much. I think that's crazy. The other aspect to it is that social media offers kind of an informal referendum on issues of the day. And it also offers the government the opportunity to respond to them. They're not going to respond to all of them, but they do apparently respond to many of them, which is, in effect, improving governance, which seems all to the good. And it's hard to be critical of that, in fact.
Absolutely. I mean, the government's very aware of how rich this online space is. And even when I see editorials that seem to be, that intend to have a chilling effect on online speech, you know, the internet is not outside the law. Users of Weibo need to take responsibility for what they say. It at least shows me that the government is aware of, you know, the import of this issue. And I think you're absolutely right that even if we don't engage Michael Antti's question, right, which is a very important question, forget about whether it's going to change China. How is this useful to us right now, right? And I think for Westerners who want to understand China, right, for people who want to build mutual understanding that's going to help the world's most important relationship between the U.S. and China, this is a very valuable tool. And for people in the Chinese government, right, they may not have, they don't have the sort of automatic democratic feedback process that you have in other countries. And so for them, it's also a valuable tool. And it really is, as you say, an informal referendum or a window into sentiment. So for those reasons alone, I think it's you know, tremendously important. there's no other questions, I'll just say, you know, thank you all very much for coming. I know it's cold. I know some of you came from somewhat far afield. So really honored to be here. And thanks to Berkman and MIT Center for Civic Media. And if you want to come up and ask me questions, you know, after everyone disperses, I'll be happy to chat. So thank you. Please check us out.